This is KGPR Great Falls at 89.9 FM. I am Matt Donnelly. I'm here in the studio, in fact, on Zoom, with a very special guest, Great Falls Symphony conductor and music director, Grant Harville. Good afternoon, Grant.
Good afternoon, Matt. Good to be here.
Awesome. And can you tell us a little bit about yourself to introduce who Grant Harville really is?
Such a personal question, but I've been in Great Falls now for this is my fourth year in the city working with the symphony, and it's been great. We're off to a good, I guess I can't call it quite a start anymore, but I'm proud of the work we've done. I'm originally from Wisconsin and grew up in a small town in the middle of nowhere in rural Wisconsin. And so a Midwestern, Northern boy at heart, but after a few stops in various places in the country, I made my way to Montana. I've been conducting now for about a little over 10 years in the professional orchestral world. And and at the moment, I split my time between Great Falls and Victoria, British Columbia, where I have some... family. So that's made a little bit more difficult in the pandemic. The travel time issues have changed that dynamic quite a bit. But if I'm not here, I'm there, and vice versa as a rule.
And what are some of your favorite composers?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. It's one that I get asked a lot. And I basically have a couple different answers to it. One, which is a total lie. But it's an easy one to say because it goes quickly. And I just say Bach, Brahms, and Stravinsky. Those are three composers that I really like. And so it works as a quick answer to that question. But the real answer to that question is that as corny as it sounds, my favorite music is always the music that I'm working at that time. Mm-hmm. And it's just because, you know, when you're getting really invested in a piece, the other music sort of fades out of your awareness a little bit. And as much as I can sort of remember on an intellectual level that I really like some piece that I conducted 2 years ago or something like that, mm-hmm. It's just sort of far removed from your mind. It's not sort of felt as an emotional reality the same way. So it's really, you know, my favorite music at any given time is almost always what I'm working on that time, what's happening on the current concert. And it's, as much as anything, it's just because it's what's kind of dominating, like, your interest and your sort of emotional commitment at that point.
Wow. And what are some, I know that, you've been probably asked this before, but what are some of your favorite classical pieces in particular? Like, what is one in classical piece in particular that really kind of deep down touches you the most, or something that you can listen to over and over again?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's something that really does depend on circumstance, sort of where you are in your life and things like that. I think, like most people, there's music that has a kind of nostalgia to it, music that you grow up with that will always take you to an interesting place because of that. Mm-hmm. And so some of the earliest orchestra music that I got to know when I was 12, 13, 14, one of them was Romeo and Juliet by Sergei Prokofiev.
Ah, good one.
The Russian composer. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, fantastic stuff. I got a CD as a gift 1 year, and I used to listen to that every night when I was falling asleep. And so that one definitely has a place in my heart. It's just basically, you know, it's 2 hours of like fantastic melodies. Like, mm-hmm. you know, for any other composer, like just that number of melodies would have been a career, you know, but he managed to get all of that into one piece. And it's, just astonishingly beautiful stuff.
Oh, yes. Just, I love that piece too, especially that one of the March of the Knights. That's my favorite movement out of that particular piece. Dun, 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 dun. Very tough and martial sounding.
What? Yeah. The Knight's Dance is a great one for sure. It's a weird thing. You know, most people know it from the suite, where it's part of a movement called Montagues and Capulets. And it's been sort of grafted on to a different part of the ballet called The Knight's Decree, which don't happen next to each other in the original ballet. So in my own mind, those are two separate things, two separate events, but in the suite, they're kind of combined into one. And it took me a while to get used to that.
And what really got you into conducting?
I never wanted to be a conductor. I'm not one of these people who will come up and say, I've been meaning to be a conductor since I was 8 years old. That is not me. It never has been. I wanted to be a performer. I played various instruments in my life, started as a violist and a pianist, got really serious about playing tuba, sing a lot. Conducting was sort of never thing, anything I wanted to do. I wanted to write music, compose. Basically, what happened is that they forced me to take a conducting class when I was in undergraduate school, and it just sort of clicked. It's like, oh, I see. This is what I really wanted to do this whole time. I just didn't realize it. I think it's because as a conductor, you get to kind of do everything. You're on stage, so you get to perform. But I was always someone who really liked my music theory classes, my music history classes, orchestration. I really like talking about music, and I really like orchestra music. And so I think all of those things kind of fell together into one package as a conductor. And it just took me a while to sort of realize that. And so that's been kind of the trajectory I've been on ever since.
And how has COVID lately impacted the orchestra and the conducting as a whole?
As odd as it sounds, there's been actually a lot of positives for us in Great Falls. We've had to do things differently for sure, but in some ways it's been good. One thing is that we've had to learn a lot about technology, right? And these are things that are going to be useful for us going forward, no matter what happens, making recordings and doing things online and stuff like that. The other thing that we knew going into this season is that things were going to be really uncertain in terms of having live audiences or not, canceling entirely, all of that stuff. So we knew pretty early on that we weren't going to be able to do our usual subscription model where we ask people to buy season tickets and things like that. And so we decided, you know what? We're just going to make everything we do free, whether it's live, whether it's online, and just say, you want to show up, just come. You have to reserve a ticket, but we weren't going to charge anything, and we were going to rely on the generosity of our patrons and community, and that's actually worked out remarkably well. We're tremendously grateful for the support we've received from the community to help get us through this season. So, I think in a lot of ways, remarkably, we'll take a lot of positives away from this year.
And since with the onset of social distancing becoming so commonplace lately, how did you arrange the orchestra as required in the restrictions as opposed in the orchestration of the particular piece, like for instance, a big giant score by Beethoven, and how is that minimized as far as setting up the orchestra in this day and age of COVID and social distancing?
Sure. Yeah. So we're having to set up 6 feet apart, and we have slightly smaller string sections than we generally use. Our stage is pretty big, so we're able to fit a decent number of musicians. But yeah, we do scale back just a touch, and certainly some of the repertoire choices we've made. So instead of, say, Beethoven's Ninth, which has gigantic chorus and things like that, for this program, we're doing Beethoven's Second, which is more of a chamber symphony. And so we've certainly been thinking about what repertoire we can do with those smaller numbers. But as I say, again, you can see it as something of an opportunity too. There are pieces we've done this year, pieces that I really love, that might not have made it onto our stage under other circumstances. And so the fact that that's happened again has been a pretty cool thing.
And with the arrangement of the orchestra, has there been any other musicians that have tried performing on Zoom? Because I know that lately that musicians have been performing on Zoom with the orchestra as opposed to being all together in the same room.
I mean, we haven't tried that. I know that there's a lot of kind of technological things in play there involving like latency and things like that in order to get things synced up or doing repertoire where it doesn't matter if you're entirely perfectly synced up or not. And of course, if you pre-record things, you can put things together afterwards as another way of doing that. But I think we felt that for us, our best chance at success is to have the musicians together again, responsibly so, masked up as their instruments allow and separated, and to do things that way. As it is, even that kind of separation introduces its own challenges. String players in particular are used to having a stand partner who helps them with page turns and things like that, and now they all have their own stand, and even that challenge is a new one that we have to be considering.
And I can imagine the challenges, especially in the brass section, of how they have to, I don't know if they have to perform with their masks on or they have to do a little bit of both, taking them off, putting it back on again.
Yeah, basically the idea is once you get to your chair, then the masks come off. And there's been a lot of research. People have been studying these things a lot over the last year about just how far these projectiles go and things like that. And it seems to be we looking at the studies that have been done that the 6 foot distance, as long as people aren't moving around and closer than that, once they're seated, that 6 foot distance seems to be fine for the wind players as well.
And how did the symphony preview start?
It was one of my babies when I first came to Great Falls. As I said earlier, I love talking about music. I love talking about music with our patrons. And so when I first came, I said, I'd really love to do kind of a, not quite a class, but just a sort of session before every concert where we can just ask people to come together and talk, and I'll play some examples, and I'll talk about some things in the music that they can listen for, and they can ask questions. I love these sort of Q&A sessions. Those have always been a lot of fun for me too. And I think the main difference is that I always like to do them before the concert, not like directly before, but a day or two before. And that just allows it to be a little bit longer. We don't have to say, well, I have to go get my tux on now or anything like that. We can, if it goes over by a few minutes or if somebody wants to stop me in the hallway on the way out or something, that's kind of cool. Obviously, now we're doing them, I'm doing them through YouTube as a streaming thing, which is a different dynamic too, but it works really well. You just have to ask questions through the sort of YouTube chat function and things like that. But it's a lot of the same features as before. And and it's a great opportunity just to meet, musically interested folks in our community too. So it's actually, for me, it's one of my favorite parts of the gig, which is why I really wanted to make sure we started that when I arrived.
Yeah, it's a great way to bring the community together as a whole to get to know more about classical music or even the symphony if they're not too familiar with going to the symphony. That way they can come and be impressed of what they have to offer.
Yeah, I think, if people haven't heard us before, I don't know if they have preconceived notions about how that's going to go, but I like to think that whatever those might be, that they're at worst pleasantly surprised by the quality of what we do. And there's a, I forget where I saw this, but there was a study that says that the biggest indicator of whether someone will like a musical work is whether they've heard it before. And so another thing that that preview does, if nothing else, it gives them one chance to get their ears on the piece before they hear it in concert. And I think it just makes the concert that much more satisfying as a result.
And can you tell us the pieces that were performed during the last concert you did, in case if they missed what the last concert was?
Yeah, so last Saturday we didn't have that as a live concert. We just did that as a recording session, and that That recording will be streaming Sunday. I guess that's January 24th at 2 p.m. And this is this program is old school. It's all music from the early to mid 1800s. And one of the big kind of classical music events of 2020, which sort of didn't happen because of a lot of things not happening in 2020, was the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth, born in December of 1770. We don't know the exact date. And obviously, a lot of people were celebrating that milestone, and those celebrations had to change and be adjusted or perhaps canceled. But it's something we wanted to acknowledge, and this concert was sort of our opportunity to do so. We're in 2021 now, obviously, but we're actually only about a month after that particular milestone anniversary. So, the program here, we feature one work by Beethoven, Symphony Number 2, which we chose again because it's a more chamber-like symphony of Beethoven's, which allows for the whole distancing thing to happen. But we're also doing an overture by Louise Ferenc, who was a pianist and a piano teacher, a prominent piano teacher in her day, the only woman to be a full-time high-ranked professor at the Paris Conservatory in her time, as well as being a very good pianist and composer. And you can hear, like every composer of her generation, Beethoven cast a long shadow. So she's of the same generation as people like Schumann and Mendelssohn and Berlioz and Franz Liszt and people like that. And all of them were sort of having to deal with this kind of looming presence of Beethoven. And you can definitely hear Beethoven's influence in her works as well, including this overture that we're performing. And then, sort of to the other end of that spectrum, is this bassoon concerto by Gioachino Rossini, famed opera composer of pieces like Barber of Seville and William Tell, who sort of occupies the space that Beethoven didn't. Beethoven wrote one opera, and it's a famous one. It's done a lot, Fidelio. But that was. Opera was difficult for Beethoven in some ways. It didn't come easily. It's something that took a lot of work and a lot of stress for him to produce. And Rossini is the other way around. He could churn out these things like nobody's business. And he was a hit machine as far as opera composers went, to the point where he was able to retire a rich man at age 37. And so once he had retired, he sort of composed kind of when he felt like it, took some teaching jobs and things like that. And this bassoon concerto emerged sometime in the 1840s as a piece written for one of his students in Bologna, where he was teaching. There is, in fact, some speculation that this student actually wrote the piece himself and tried to pass it off as Rossini's, or perhaps Rossini wrote part of it and the student finished it, or something along those lines. But we don't know for sure. That's all speculation. What we do know is that the piece was lost for many, many years. It was just sort of a rumor until someone found it on a shelf in the mid-1990s. So it hasn't been played much at all, but bassoonists, of course, are extremely excited to have this new, potentially Rossini work in available to them.
And when can we access the preview for this January 24th streamed concert?
So the preview is actually available now. It's on my personal YouTube channel. Obviously, you won't be able to participate in the chat, the back and forth, since it's pre-recorded at this point. But yeah, if you head to my YouTube, it should be there for all to find.
And also, will there be any future concerts or previews that are coming up this year?
Yeah, so any of our symphony concerts, I'll do a preview for. Our next program is February, our Heartstrings concert. And then our season closing symphony concert is in April, Testaments, we're calling it. If you want to see the exact dates of those previews and concerts, you can head to gfsymphony.org for that.
And referring back to the bassoon player, can you tell us about the soloist in the previous concert that you recorded?
Sure. We actually are featuring Dorian Antipo, who is our principal bassoonist. We like to make sure we're giving opportunities to some of our core musicians to be soloists with the orchestra, especially this year. Another sort of COVID adjustment is that we didn't want to have soloists traveling from all over the world to be here. So we featured a lot of local musicians. And when I was talking to Dorian about possibilities, this was a piece that he suggested. Again, I think bassoonists are really excited about it because it's a relatively new thing by a famous composer, sort of a kind of new unexpected find in the repertoire, which is kind of rare. But it's also a piece that has, whether it's by Rossini or not, it has a lot of kind of Rossini-ish charm to it, the sort of nice, satisfying melodies and all the sort of flashy virtuosic stuff that made Rossini rich and famous.
And can you tell us any information about where we can find future concerts or previews for those that want to get to know the symphony a lot more?
Yeah, I think the best thing to do if you want more information is to head to our website, gfsymphony.org. You'll find links there to the programs we've done this year. So if you want to hear some of the recordings we've already made, you can find them there. If you want to find information about upcoming programs, that's there. There are links to my previews. Again, you could go directly to my YouTube channel if you want to, but they're linked through the website as well. So that's the easiest thing to do, especially since normally I might send someone to a box office, but since we're not selling tickets, that may or may not be an appropriate option this time around.
Can you tell us more about Beethoven's Second Symphony? Kind of a little history behind it?
Sure. So Beethoven wrote a Second Symphony in 1802. And if you're a huge Beethoven fan, that date might set off some alarm bells. This was at a time in Beethoven's life when, on the surface, things were going really well for him. He had established himself in Vienna as sort of the leading pianist of his day. More and more people were getting interested in his compositions. But what they didn't know, and what was only too obvious to Beethoven himself, is that he was going deaf, and he was getting deafer and deafer, and it was getting worse before it was getting better. And so in the year 1802, he sort of retreats to the countryside for the summer and writes a very famous letter called the Heiligenstadt Testament, which is kind of a letter to his brothers, kind of a legal document, but mostly he's just sort of pouring out his heart about how sort of devastating it is for him to be going deaf and how embarrassing it is for him to be going deaf, to be this sort of great musician and having his senses betray him in this way. And the sort of ironic part is that you'd think that any music that he produced at this time would be very sort of brooding and angsty and tortured. And yet the Second Symphony is actually the opposite. It's a very sunny, upbeat kind of piece. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, Beethoven wasn't immersed in the orchestral world the way that someone like Haydn before him was. Beethoven was a pianist, and he was a legendarily bad violinist. Mm-hmm. And so the symphony wasn't his vehicle for making sort of personal statements. That was more the piano sonata. He really felt sort of more in control of that genre. And so he could be sort of very precise about getting his heart into those pieces relatively early on. It would take Beethoven longer to be that comfortable with symphonies. So when he's writing his second symphony, you can hear him sort of looking to his models. And in particular, there's a lot of sort of Haydn-ish charm and joy in his second symphony. Even the key, the D major, is a kind of triumphant key, and it echoes Haydn's 104th symphony as well. So wow. It's this weird contrast between what was going on in Beethoven's personal life and the sort of mood of one of the major works that he writes in 1802. And in retrospect, it actually feels like Beethoven is sort of giving a kind of valedictory wave to his mentors and his idols, in the sort of classical symphony. We know now that he was going to change the way symphonies were wrote forever, were written forever. But this is sort of his last version of the kind of conservative traditional symphony.
And that's what I've always admired about Beethoven. He never let his disability get the best of him. He just triumphed as in later in life with all the great pieces that he wrote, and he just felt it right in his heart. And even if he couldn't hear it, and he just kept right on going, and yet became one of the greatest, if not the greatest, classical composer of all time.
Yeah, you know, in the Heiligenstadt Testament, he actually says he's very blunt that if he didn't have this sort of hope of producing these compositions, that he probably would take his own life. And so it's definitely his ability to do that acts as a kind of lifeline for him.
Yeah, I mean, he's just out and out wonderful. I mean, like I said, he had just had the music all in him, with in his heart and in his mind. It's just brilliant.
Well, and it's an interesting thing to consider, right? Where, you know, Beethoven never went permanently completely deaf. He was always able to hear bits of things, and it got worse and worse as he went. But ultimately, he did get to a point where, you know, he was never able to actually physically hear exactly what he wrote. And so, you know, the ability to sort of create these things in his mind's ear had to be remarkably strong.
And on the topic of COVID and conducting, can you tell us about you conducting a quarantine series?
Yeah, so on my YouTube channel, I have this thing called Conductor in Quarantine. And it's an interesting thing being a conductor when we aren't allowed to be around a lot of people in person. Since conducting, sort of by its very nature, requires other people to be in the room. So I think one thing that conductors over the last year have had to sort of grapple with is, you know, even under the best of circumstances, there's always this question about how useless you are. But in this particular circumstance, that's an especially strong sort of issue that you have to deal with. You know, how are you making music? How are you staying engaged? How are you contributing? And so, yeah, I made this sort of series of videos where it shows me practicing and working on sort of conducting skills and things like that, just ways of kind of keeping my musical brain engaged, even if I can't wave my arms at musicians the way I usually do.
That's awesome. I'm glad that we got to finally do this interview. This is wonderful. Again, this is Matt Donnelly of KGPR Great Falls at 89.9 FM, and we have been talking with music director and Great Falls Symphony conductor and music director Grant Harville. And again, do you have any final thoughts about any future concerts or anything else in particular?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is that we're just so incredibly grateful, you know, in Great Falls to have the support that we have. A lot of musicians, a lot of people in lots of fields are really struggling. And the fact that we've been able to keep doing what we've been doing in some form, even in weird forms, recorded with masks on and things like that, is a tremendous privilege. And it's not something we take for granted. And it can only happen because of a community sort of rallying around us in this way. And so it's very important to us that we're able to repay that with really great performances of music that people will love.
Great. And again, this is, we just interviewed Grant Harville, and thank you for being a part of this wonderful interview, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Matt. Great to be here.